Hey, howdy, space nerds. Are you liking this podcast so far? Well, Are We There Yet is supported by listeners just like you. So consider showing your support with a financial contribution to WMFE. You can do that by visiting wmfe.org/support. Your gift helps us better explore exploration. And thanks. From the studios at WMFE in Orlando, Florida, this is the Space Exploration Podcast that asks the question, are we there yet? Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Do you recognize this speech?
There is no strife, no prejudice, no national conflict in outer space as yet. Its hazards are hostile to us all. Its conquest deserves the best of all mankind. And its opportunity for peaceful cooperation may never come again.
All right, I'll make it a little bit easier. How about now?
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win, and the others too.
John F. Kennedy's speech sent the U.S. on a moonshot. And by the end of the decade, just as he said, we put men on the moon. Now we're looking to Mars as our next moonshot, with visionaries like NASA's Charlie Bolden and SpaceX's Elon Musk promising to send humans to the red planet. But it takes more than just a speech, and there's speed bumps all along the way. Well, this week we're going to shift gears a bit and take a historic look at the programs that achieved enormous goals, but also look at some of the low points in space history, from JFK's moonshot to this generation's Mars shot. Now, joining us this week is Michael McConville. He's got an interesting perspective to bring to the program. Michael's a space geek, and he's a coordinator at the Bueller Planetarium at the Seminole State College here in Central Florida. But he's also a professor of history at the University of Central Florida. Michael, thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you so much, Brendan, for having me on.
So let's go ahead. Let's start at the moon here. So all eyes were on the first moon landing of Apollo 11. But after that, we started to see public interest tail off a little bit. You know, what happened in those years and what kind of impact did that have on the later Apollo missions?
A lot of it had to do with that at the time, the percentage of NASA's budget, the percentage compared to what we have in our national budget was starting to decrease. Even at the time that we have people landing on the moon, the Nixon administration had originally wanted all the way out to Apollo 20. They cut Apollo 20, then they cut 18 and 19. And there was talk for a little while that they were going to cut 16 and 17 as well. And one of the deputy budget directors, Casper Weinberger, I think it was, went to Nixon and lobbied on behalf of NASA to keep those alive. And those were two of the more scientifically important missions that we had. But once you got to the moon and we beat the Russians, and once you had actually completed the task that John F. Kennedy had set out, there wasn't a sense that there was much more to learn.
But that was, I'm sure, totally different from the folks at NASA, the scientists and engineers,
yes.
Right?
And what they were able to do is that they built all of these Saturn V rockets, and they were able to repurpose them into the Skylab mission, so for our first space station up in orbit. And it was a very useful tool because we had an Apollo-Soyuz mission in the middle of the 1970s, kind of in the aftermath of Watergate and sort of the political upheaval here in the United States, where you have the United States and the Soviet Union doing this very, very impressive technological feat, you know, a few hundred miles above the surface of the Earth.
So what would have happened if those last two Apollo missions were canceled? Can we kind of think about what would have happened if we didn't have those?
The NASA programs had between 6 and 8 different locations chosen. And what it would have meant would probably have been longer times on the surface. The Apollo 17 mission brought something close to 400 pounds of rocks back, and we would have seen that number increase. But we'd be able to try out new things, and we'd have the lunar rovers would have been able to travel farther away from the landers. And we'd have this much more focus on the science side rather than the spectacle that Apollo 11 was and the sort of grip that Apollo 13 had on everyone in the country. Once you got past that, though, you know, the science side of it is great. And for the people at NASA, for the space nerds of the 70s, those things were awesome. But for everybody else, there just seemed to be a diminishing return on investment. And so It's probably a good thing that we didn't go all the way to Apollo 20. It probably hastened the coming of the space shuttle. But for those people working on the Apollo program and on those Saturn rockets, it would have been, you know, two or three more missions where they're really able to delve deeper into those mysteries in the moon.
Now, speaking of those Apollo missions, that space race that you mentioned, that had some significant military and political ramifications in the 60s. You and I would probably look at the more scientific thing, but kind of bring us up to speed on what some of those impacts the space race actually had on us politically and militarily.
Well, of course, when you're starting in the 1960s, there's a sense that, especially after 1957, when the Russians launched Sputnik into orbit, it's the beginning of the space race, and there's the coming of what at the time was known as the missile gap. It was the idea that the Soviet Union was so far ahead of the United States in things like missile technology and the ability to transport nuclear weapons across the world, that almost all of the early rockets, and so even the programs that we're familiar with today, the Atlas program, the Delta, all of those had connections back to either intermediate range or the intercontinental ballistic missiles that then got repurposed to put somebody on top of it. So instead of putting a nuclear warhead on top of the missile, you put a capsule with somebody inside of it. And so John Glenn orbits the Earth in 1962 on the top of a rocket that was meant to bomb Moscow. This connection between the military and NASA that exists all throughout the 60s and 70s, the shuttle program, there were at least 10 or 11 classified missions, one of which is still classified to today. We know who was on it. We know what orbit it took. We don't know anything else about it. So for us, going to the moon, being able to put men on another world, but more importantly, to just get that much material off the Earth, Saturn V would have been 130 tons worth of material. It just showed how much more advanced we were than the Soviets. And really, from a military standpoint, 1969, getting onto the moon, the Soviets knew that from a technology standpoint, the United States was in the lead and would remain in the lead throughout the rest of the Cold War.
And would we have gotten there if it wasn't for that competition or that tension between those two superpowers?
It's probable, but not at the speed that we saw. We get the speech of John F. Kennedy in 1961 says we're going to go to the moon. We haven't yet put a man into orbit. Mm-hmm. We've had some suborbital flights, but we've never been able to get a man in orbit. John Glenn is the next year in 1962. Then by 1969, we have Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walking on the surface. It is a combination of this urgency to be able to show the world that the United States was still at the very, very top militarily, but also just an immense sense of national pride. And I think more than anything else, having Americans on the surface was as much a great thing for this country as just the technological advances that it took to get there.
And it's incredible when you kind of look at the physical scale that went from that first program in the early 60s to landing on the moon in 69. You look at the Mercury Redstone, and you look at Saturn V. I'm reminded of it every day I go out there to work. When you pick up your press credentials, there's a Mercury Redstone. It's not very big, you know. It's you know, a few tens of feet up there. And then you go and you see the Saturn V, which they have to build a separate building to show you what it looks like. That it's incredible that things progressed that fast.
Oh, yeah. And the Saturn system, the Saturn rocket family, started all the way back in 1960. It was actually predating our manned flight because we thought we would be able to use this heavier lift rocket. But as we're building bigger, longer range rockets to be able to transport more and heavier warheads, we're using that technology and the advances that come from that to say, well, now we can build an even larger rocket. And Saturn V was one of the first rockets in the inventory that didn't have a military purpose. What you would do with 130 tons of payload is beyond me. But they built the Saturn V specifically for NASA and for spaceflight. Almost all of the other systems were military in nature, and that arms race was as much an issue of the space race as anything else. And, it did work out in our favor.
I think that's an interesting point, that was really just made for that purpose.
Yeah.
So, well, we talked a little bit about the end of Apollo. Now, the next chapter in human spaceflight doesn't happen until about 81 with the shuttle. So we have the end of Apollo in 71, is that right?
75.
and the shuttle in 81. What happened in that gap between those years? Was there a brain drain, or did what kind of what happened?
What made this spaceflight gap, and so the U.S. government, NASA, has used the term spaceflight gap for the late 70s and for the period of time that we're currently in, as a sense of transition. And so we had begun working on the space shuttle system in the late 60s, and the space shuttle program was originally much, much larger than just the orbiter that we're familiar with. There was the Freedom Space Station. There was going to be an orbital tug that would actually be able to move satellites and other spacecraft around. And then there was the hope of a nuclear-powered system that would take us to the moon, that would take us beyond the orbit of the moon, and then eventually out into interplanetary space. And because of all of the cutbacks and the economic downturns in the 70s, the shuttle was the one part that remained. And so even though you had this system go from four components to one, there was still something in the pipeline. There was a belief that something bigger and better was coming down the line. And since we were moving towards this age of reusable spacecraft, most of the people in NASA, most of the people in the U.S. government saw this as a necessary time. Fast forward to today, you know, we've been without the ability to get humans in space from the United States since about 2011 and the end of the shuttle program, is that things happen far faster nowadays. And so there is this sense of expediency that we need to be able to be on top of everyone else at all times, to the detriment often of the systems themselves. And so you had the original Constellation system that was supposed to take over, that's evolved into the SLS and Space Launch System. But it's good for us. I mean, within the next 2 or 3 years, the United States is very much going to be able to take its place, I think, at the very, very top of human space flight. And so between the SLS and all the work that Blue Origin and SpaceX are doing, we still have the Starliner from Boeing. All of these systems coming together are very, very rapidly going to allow us to reach the sort of personnel levels in space that we would feel comfortable with all over again.
But looking historically, and you see, you know, public interest wanes in Apollo. You see the shuttle program that was supposed to be these four components whittled down to one. Do you see the same thing happening for SLS, or has it already been whittled down and public interest has waned already?
I think one of the most impressive aspects of SLS to begin with is just how much they've been able to do with how little that NASA's been given over this maybe last decade or so. It's a function that people are very interested in science, that today it seems that the amazing things that we hear about every day have become mundane. And so, yes, putting a man on the moon is so completely different than anything we've ever experienced before. But then when you've done it 2, 3, 4 times, it's an everyday occurrence. You put the shuttle in orbit, you bring it back down to Earth, you run it through the processing, and you're back in orbit in 3 or 4 months. That's an impressive feat. But then when you're watching Challenger in 86, or you're seeing Columbia come back in 03, and you see these very drastic changes to the program, you know, how we deal with the space shuttles, and the loss of life is a huge thing. There have been 22 deaths in the history of spaceflight in spacecraft. And that is a small number out of the 800-900 people or so that have been to space. But there's something about that loss that strikes people. And it's the danger of space flight and human exploration that I think for a lot of people causes them to pull back a little bit. It's great getting the pictures from Hubble, but there's nothing that we have to do or risk to get those. Mm-hmm. If we go to Mars, you may never come back. And that there is the launch and the orbital insertion and the trip over and the descent to the surface. There's all of these opportunities for something to go wrong. And, you know, we've been watching science fiction now for, you know, most of the last 50 or 60 years. We know what's supposed to happen in space. Mm-hmm. And those are the sorts of things that have been built into people's minds, this public conscience of what space is going to be like and what space might mean for us as we move forward. You know, we're comfortable here on Earth. It is the final frontier. It's scary and it's mysterious and it's an unknown.
But even with that said, and knowing the 22 losses of life, the 2 major accidents on shuttle, engineers knowing that you know, the shuttle turnaround time wasn't what they wanted it to be. It wasn't the right system, and the consensus was it was time to move on. But still, the end of the shuttle program was very difficult on a lot of the public. They didn't think it was the right thing to do. I mean, even with all those things being said, you know, how does that kind of make you feel about the moving forward from this?
It's a matter of education. You know, most people weren't aware that to launch a space shuttle was usually as much as $500 million. And then you had to bring it back down Earth safely. And then you go through the processing, and that might be another $1 billion. So every time you're sending something into orbit, it is reusable, but at a very, very high cost. And we're using a system that was becoming increasingly difficult to upgrade, whether it's the avionics on board or the boosters. These things get old real quick. And when you're sending things hurtling into space at 17,000 miles per hour, there are
a little bit of wear and tear, right?
Levels of tolerance that are a little different than what we're used to here on the planet. And so it's getting people aware, and this goes for just about anything in our public discourse, is that there's so much nuance to these answers. That once you're able to sort of sit down and people are aware of everything that goes into this, then that sense of wonder and amazement, you know, the SLS is going to be the biggest rocket that anybody's ever seen, until, of course, Elon Musk gets his way. But the SLS is going to be this absolutely astonishing piece of technology. And once we're aware of what has gone into it and what it means for us moving forward, that's when I think the public kind of comes around to it and re-engages with space science and with human spaceflight in a way that we haven't had in a very, very long time.
And Michael, what's it going to be? Is it going to be that first launch that gets the people involved? Because they're going to need the public support before that to get the money. How do you get the... It's difficult for people like us. We have our blinders on and we live and breathe this stuff. But how do you get the rest of the country on board with a plan like NASA's journey to Mars or with Elon's colonization plan? How do you do that?
It's kind of hearkening back to the JFK speech in the 60s. It is this sense of, you know, throughout American history, we've always had this pull to expand, to explore, to see different and new things. And I think that once you kind of instill that into people, that this is necessary for our future as a country, it's necessary for the future of our planet, it's necessary for us to understand our planet, then you can get people to really buy in and invest in something that the vast majority of people are never going to be getting on a spacecraft. And as great as a million people to Mars in a century sounds, there are huge obstacles in the way. And if it's going to be 1% of that, it's still an amazing advancement, but it's not a million people. It's being able to realize, hey, human beings are able to put people on the top of a metal tube and put really big fire at the bottom and blast them off into space at speeds you can't scarcely imagine and put them on another world. It's tapping into that emotion that everybody has as a kid, that everything's huge and everything is amazing and astonishing and everything needs to be explored. And then you get older and that sort of amazement wanes. We can bring that back. And I think it's the job of, you know, the political leaders. It's the job of the administrators at NASA. But it's also the job of sort of the science educators and the science popularizers. Social media is such an excellent way to do this nowadays, where you can follow 10, 15, 100 people and know what's going on at all times and understand what's going on behind the scenes and get that sense of wonder and amazement back.
You keep mentioning that JFK speech, the "We Choose to Go to the Moon" speech. You know, with this Elon Musk announcement at IAC recently, a lot of people were hoping that would be our generation's moon speech. That would be our generation's JFK speech. Do you think Elon lived up to that hype? Was that what's going to get people involved, that speech with that giant interplanetary transport system? Is he the next JFK when it comes to this?
He certainly has the charisma to be. I think that what separates JFK's speech from, say, what Elon Musk did is that we are in a much more fractured environment, to where pretty much everyone in the country was aware of JFK's speech. They heard it. It was played over. You would read the newspaper. You could see the transcript. with Elon Musk, you probably wanted to know about it. You would tune in, you'd see the live cast, and you'd enjoy it. But you don't have to engage with it. It's not something that would be directly in front of us. And so for those of us who were really, really into that kind of stuff, seeing it was inspiring. And it was, before at least the question and answer session, a very, very impressive speech. And it's, you know, kind of light on details, but it's the vision of JFK. It's not a bad copy of it. It's a very, very good interpretation of JFK. And so I think with Elon, I don't think that the United States is ever going to trust a president and invest in that the way that they did with JFK. It's just, I don't think it's in our political environment right now. But to have somebody like an Elon Musk in the private sector who's saying, I'm done being rich and I'm done making all the money that I can. I want to do something that's going to change the history of humankind. That's a level that I think people can get to where that vision is so big and so clear that we'll forgive the lack of details for the hope that this is something that we're going to be capable of doing, not in the distant future, but within our lifetimes, and certainly within, say, the next generation's lifetime, that we're going to see people walk on Mars, and we may see people live on Mars for very long periods of time.
Have we ever seen a visionary to the scale of Elon and his Mars plan in the history of the United States or even in the history of the world?
I think in terms of the vision, you could talk about somebody like Albert Einstein. It's a different vision. It's vision in a different sense. You could go back to the Enlightenment thinkers who completely upended thousands of years of thought. And then the scientific revolution, those visionaries, the Galileos and the Newtons of the world, who could have accepted the dogma of the day, decided not to, did something very, very different, took massive risks, sometimes at the expense of their own lives, or at least their own livelihoods. And so, you know, we'll wait and see where Musk kind of lands in the great pantheon of visionary thinkers. But it is exciting to have somebody like that right now. And more than anything, I think the most important part about Elon Musk's vision is to inspire the next generation of visionaries to say, well, that sounds great, but it's still a rocket launching from KSC, and we're going to get into orbit, and we've got to do all these tankers, and we'll get to Mars. Now we need somebody to come in and say, Elon Musk, that's the mainstream. That's the standard bearer. Let's do something that's going to disrupt even that. Mm-hmm. Come in and do something different and really, I hope, bring a level of intellectual competition to this that's going to drive human spaceflight and exploration of the solar system and maybe even beyond as quickly as we possibly can.
It kind of reminds me of the early railroad tycoons of the U.S., you know, providing this massive plan, massive building project, but actually brought something good to, you know, to the American citizens.
Oh, yeah. And this is, you know, we've gained a lot from NASA and from the space program over the last 60 years and a lot of great additions to everyday life. And I think that whether it's a public entity like NASA or it's a private entity like SpaceX, you still have the drive and competition that usually leads to very, very rapid increases in what we're able to do. I don't think in 10 years we're going to be talking about the interplanetary transport system and the SLS the way we do today. We're going to be talking about two or three generations ahead of that. And that's good for NASA. That's good for SpaceX. And it's really good for people who care about space exploration.
Let's talk about that intellectual competition. If you're on Twitter, you can see that Elon Musk's competition is Jeff Bezos and Blue Origin. And I think we're in a much different time when it comes to space exploration and space flight and the aerospace industry with all these private players. Now, there's way more than just Blue Origin and SpaceX. But what's your take historically on where we are when it comes to SpaceX, Blue Origin, ULA, Bigelow, Moon Express, all of these private players coming into the game now?
It can only be good. When you have, you know, a very small number of contractors, if we were to go to, say, military contracts, and right now it's pretty much Boeing and Lockheed Martin, they produce good equipment. But when you have more and more competition and you might bid out to 5 or 10 different companies, you start to get designs that aren't conservative, that aren't sort of just little evolutions off of something that came prior. You have things that just come out of the ether. And so what we would end up having with all of these different groups is the ability with, you know, Blue Origin probably would be the best example of this, showing their capsule abort system. And it's a great, great technology, but to see it work so perfectly,
Publicly.
Yeah. And it's, you're going to watch this live and we know that it's going to work and we'll tell you that that booster might yaw and it's going to crash and then it goes away and it's perfect. You have to think that somebody at SpaceX is looking at that and going, oh, we can do that too. And we can make sure that we'll have that on all of our rockets, but we'll do it better or we'll do it different or we'll use less propellant. We'll make it lighter. We'll make it safer. And then you get this back and forth where you're going to have this very, very rapid increase in the technology and you have the private capital that's going to be able to subsidize that. You're going to have the public capital. NASA is going to get involved. And at some point when we're looking at, say, the SLS and the really, really big SpaceX systems, we've never gotten to the point where you're going to have two competing super heavy lift rockets. It's one thing to have a Delta IV or an Atlas rocket or, you know, maybe like the Falcon 9 Heavy. But when you get to these really big, you know, industry-changing designs, that's where, I mean, it's difficult to prognosticate about it, but there's some really good things that are going to come out of that, and very, very soon, I believe.
And it's not just private industry that's growing as well. There's some emerging government space agencies. Mm-hmm. Just quickly run us through some that are on your radar that you're watching.
Well, of course, the big three, the United States, Russia, and China, and they've had capabilities now for at least 20 years. But there are, you know, a number of places around the planet. The European Space Agency wants to have their own crewed space flight in the future. Japan is looking probably in the middle of the 2020s. And then there's places like Iran and Israel, North Korea is thinking about trying to put somebody in space. And up to a few years ago, Malaysia was actually looking into the idea of having a human spaceflight component to their national security or their defense. If you can build a rocket that can send a warhead somewhere on Earth, you have enough thrust to be able to get somebody at least into suborbital space, if not low Earth orbit. And so as this technology becomes easier for countries to access and build, India would probably be the prime example of this. You have this massive country with great resources that's been putting spacecraft into orbit for a number of years. They sent a space probe to Mars, and they're probably going to have someone in space within the next 2 or 3 years. And that's good because that competition is going to drive the countries to be able to say, from just a regional standpoint, India and China, there's going to be a competition there. It may not be to the level of the space race between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, but it can only be good for those two sides because we have this idea of space as being almost neutral. You know, you don't go to space and put bombs up there. It's not a militarized zone. It's the International Space Station. It's not the United States going up there. We landed 12 Americans on the moon. The moon is not American territory. It is this independent, sovereign place that seemingly most of the countries on Earth have signed on to. And so once you kind of release these people and these ideas from the bounds of the Earth, well, now you have this sort of competition between countries that hopefully breeds greater and better things rather than, oh, this is just a military exercise, that there's something we can actually get out of all of this.
The ambitious goal from Elon is humans in the 2020s, late 2020s. Mm-hmm. NASA says 2030s on Mars. What do you think? When are we going to get there?
I'll push and probably split the difference there. 2030 seems like a good time. And when we think about the 2030, we've got to remember this is only like 10, 15 years from now. Mm-hmm. It's still relatively close. But the technology is there. The drive is very clearly there. Most of it just has to do with money and being able to develop the systems to harness that technology and get people to the red planet. I think the bigger concern is not necessarily getting there. It's what we do when we finally arrive. And Is the dust too fine? Will it go through our spacesuits? If you inhale it, will it give you a Martian form of the black lung? Do we have to worry about radiation and what's it going to take to grow food? It's these sorts of everyday, you know, slightly more mundane things that I think are going to be much more of an obstacle than getting people to another world. So we've sent space probes to fly past all of the outer planets. New Horizons last year flew past Pluto. Rosetta went around Comet 67P for a couple of years. All of those are amazing feats of space technology. And so putting people on another world, it's a huge size. There's a lot of work to be done. But I think it's going to happen sooner rather than later. If I wanted to push, I'd probably say more on the Elon timeline than the NASA one.
No, the red lung sounds pretty terrifying, doesn't it? We've been speaking with Michael McConville. He's the coordinator of the Bueller Planetarium at Seminole State College. He's also a professor of history at UCF. Fascinating conversation. Thanks for coming, Michael.
Absolutely. You're welcome.
Well, that's going to do it for this episode. Support for Are We There Yet comes from the listeners of WMFE. You can follow the show online. We're on Twitter at AWTYMars. Are We There Yet, Mars? Get it? Or reach out to me in the Twitterverse. I'm at SpaceBrendan. And be sure to leave us a review on iTunes if that's how you listen. That's how more people learn about this podcast. Are We There Yet is a production of WMFE, and our theme music was composed by Kevin McLeod. Find more space news online at wmfe.org/space. As always, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.